So whenever you picture Wall Street, or just the broader financial markets in general, the image that usually comes to mind is this heavily guarded, totally impenetrable fortress.
Right, like a high-tech casino or something.
Exactly, yeah. You imagine this casino where every single microsecond of trading, like every fraction of a penny, is tracked by 100 cameras in the ceiling. You deposit your funds, the steel vault locks, and a team of guys in tailored suits stands guard.
Yeah, the classic movie version of finance.
But before we get into the reality of that, this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 99 course with adaptive study coaches, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Highly recommend it.
Yeah, it's a game changer. Because the truth is, if you want to pass the Series 99 and actually work in the back office of a broker-dealer, you learn very quickly that the fortress is basically a total illusion.
Oh, it is entirely an illusion. I mean, once you step behind the curtain into the operations side, you realize that this supposed fortress is actually built on a really precarious mountain of paperwork, legacy technology, human error, and frankly, a constant, desperate daily race against the clock.
A race to make sure the firm's math actually matches the clearinghouse's math, right?
Exactly. If it weren't for the incredibly strict operational rules forced upon these firms, it wouldn't be a fortress at all. It would be just a chaotic free-for-all where money just, well, evaporates.
Which is exactly our mission today. We are taking the operations professional cheat sheet and we are going completely under the hood. We aren't here to just read a list of retention clocks and margin requirements.
No, because memorizing a list is basically useless the second the exam throws a convoluted multi-step scenario at you.
Right, it's just dry data. So we're going to explore the actual underlying mechanics, the operational friction, the regulatory logic, and the literal back office workflow behind these rules. Because when you understand the architecture of the chaos, the exam questions just become common sense.
And to make sense of this architecture, to give you, the listener, a framework that actually sticks in your memory, we are going to look at these rules through the lens of three very specific people trying to navigate a broker-dealer firm.
I love this part. Our recurring cast of financial disasters and heroes. First up,
Yeah.
you have Careless Carl.
Oh, Carl.
Yeah, Carl's the retail customer. He clicks every single phishing link. He throws away his tax forms. He loves trading on margin without understanding the risks. And he fundamentally believes the rules just don't apply to him.
He is literally the reason the SEC and FINRA mandate customer protection rules. Every time a firm has to jump through some massive bureaucratic hoop, it's usually to save a careless Carl from himself, or, to save the firm from him.
Right. Then sitting on the other side of the desk, we have Frank, the founder. Frank owns the broker-dealer.
And Frank is a nightmare.
Total nightmare. He's chaotic, highly leveraged, and always looking for a shortcut. He views compliance not as a legal obligation, but as like an annoying suggestion that cuts into his profit margins. He wants to use customer money to fund his proprietary trading, and he absolutely hates leaving a paper trail.
Right, and if Frank is left to his own devices, the regulators don't just fine his firm, they padlock the doors.
Which brings us to the only person holding this whole ecosystem together, Diligent Diane.
The unsung hero of the back office.
Exactly. Diane is the FinOps and compliance principal. She holds the Series 99, the Series 27, you name it. She's one constantly running around the office with a fire extinguisher, fixing Frank's fat finger trade errors, freezing Carl's accounts when he tries to wire money to a prince in another country,
Right.
and calculating the firm's exact capital requirements every single Friday afternoon.
Diane represents you, the listener, once you pass this exam, because if you look at the entire scope of the Series 99, it really boils down to three core mandates that Diane has to enforce:
Which
moving money securely, protecting customer assets from the firm itself, and leaving a flawless, immutable paper trail.
Okay, let's start right at the threshold. Segment one, the front door. Because before Frank can actually put Careless Carl's money at risk in the market, he has to get Carl through the door.
Right, and legally, an account being born in the back office is a surprisingly heavy lift. The regulators break account opening down into distinct duties, and they absolutely refuse to let you blend them together.
This is a fundamental concept that always trips people up. So when Carl sits down to open his account, the firm has to perform three separate functions, right? Collecting the core info, the customer identification program or CIP, and know your customer KYC.
Exactly. Three distinct pillars.
But I want to push back on this separation because operationally it sounds incredibly redundant to me. If Frank takes Carl's driver's license and his social security number, doesn't that just simultaneously collect his info, prove who he is for CIP, and tell Frank how old he is for KYC suitability? Why are these separate silos?
It's a great question. It's because they serve entirely different masters and carry totally different legal liabilities.
Okay, how so?
Well, collecting the information is just the administrative baseline, right? Getting a name, address, and social security number into the firm's mainframe so they can just generate statements. But CIP, the Customer Identification Program, that stems directly from the USA Patriot Act.
Oh, wow. So it's federal law.
Right. It is a federal anti-money laundering and anti-terrorism mandate. The goal of CIP is exclusively to verify that Careless Carl is actually a real human being named Carl and not some synthetic identity created by an international crime syndicate to wash illicit funds.
So CIP is literally the firm asking, are you real and are you on an OFAC terrorist watch list?
Eh.
It has nothing to do with whether Carl is like a good investor.
Precisely. And because of that, CIP gives you a little operational breathing room. You don't have to verify the identity the exact second the account is opened.
Wait, really?
Yeah, the rule requires verification within a reasonable time before or after opening. But KYC Know Your Customer is an entirely different beast. That comes from FINRA's investor protection mandate.
Okay, so KYC is where Frank has to actually care about Carl's financial soul, so to speak.
Exactly. KYC is all about suitability and authority. It requires the firm to understand the essential facts concerning every customer, like what is Carl's investment profile, his risk tolerance, his tax status.
Right.
And crucially, does he actually have the legal authority to open a margin account, or is he acting on behalf of a trust without actually providing the trust documents? The SEC and FINRA care about KYC because they want to ensure Frank isn't pitching high-risk naked options to a 90-year-old widow who needs capital preservation.
That makes total sense. Yeah. So collecting is just data entry. CIP is anti-terrorism tracing. KYC is suitability and legal authority. That distinction is clear, but how does this play out in Diane's back office when Carl inevitably gets bored and closes his account a week later?
Ah, the retention clock.
Yeah, because I know the regulators track these different duties on totally different timelines.
They do, and this is where the exam lays a massive trap for candidates. You really need to know the literal timeline mismatch between these records.
Okay, let's pose this directly to you, the listener. Visualize Diane in the file room. Careless Carl opened his account, did one trade, hated the market, and closed the account. How long does Diane have to keep Carl's identity verification records the CIP paperwork versus his general customer account information? Take a second to mentally lock in your answer.
Yeah, if you just default to the standard broker-dealer retention timelines, you will probably get the CIP portion wrong.
The mismatch is 5 years versus 6 years, right? But what actually triggers the start of those clocks?
For identity verification records under CIP, the firm must keep them for 5 years. But the clock can start from two different events. It's 5 years from the closure of the account or 5 years from the time the record was made, depending on the specific type of CIP document.
Okay. And the KYC stuff?
The general customer account information, the KYC profile, employment status, investment objectives that must be kept for 6 years. And that 6-year clock starts ticking from either the last update to that info or from the date the account is permanently closed.
Wait, let's explore the logic of that mismatch, because to me it seems backwards. Why does the federal anti-terrorism stuff get shredded at year 5, but the FINRA suitability profile has to stick around for year 6? You'd think the government would want terrorism records kept forever.
You would think so, but it really comes down to the nature of regulatory audits and civil dispute resolutions. The 6-year retention for account information actually aligns with the FINRA arbitration statute of limitations.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, a customer generally has 6 years from the event giving rise to the dispute to file an arbitration claim. If Carl wakes up 5.5 years from now and decides Frank sold him an unsuitable mutual fund, FINRA needs to know that Diane still has Carl's original KYC profile on file to prove whether the trade was suitable or not back then.
That makes perfect sense. The 6 years is literally a shield for the firm during arbitration.
Exactly. Now, while we have Carl at the front door, we need to address the most dangerous type of account he can open, the retirement account.
Ah, yes. The individual retirement account. Because Carl's getting a little older, he saved a bit of money, and he wants to shield it from taxes.
Right. And the Series 99 expects you to know the operational boundaries of these accounts. For instance, you must be aware that contribution limits change, like the 2026 limits, which apply universally to traditional and Roth IRAs.
Right, right.
You also need to know the operational flow of required minimum distributions, or RMDs, which force money out of traditional IRAs at a certain age, but completely skip the Roth IRA during the owner's lifetime.
Right, because the Roth is funded with after-tax dollars. The IRS already took their pound of flesh before the money even went into the account, so they don't care if Carl leaves it in there until he dies. But let's get to the real operational nightmare, the rollover.
Yes. Customer-received IRA rollovers are a total minefield of tax liability. When a customer takes physical possession of their retirement funds, it triggers a very strict 60-day once-per-year clock.
Okay, let's build a scenario here to really test the friction of this rule. Careless Carl leaves his corporate job. He has $50,000 in his 401k. He calls his company's plan administrator and says, hey, send me my money.
Classic Carl move.
Totally. So they cut a physical check payable directly to Carl and mail it to his house. Carl walks into Frank's brokerage office, waves the check around and says, Frank, I've got 50 grand, but I'm going through a divorce. I want to buy a boat to live on next month. So I just want to park this check in my personal checking account for a while until the dust settles. We'll invest it in an IRA later this year.
Oh, boy.
And Frank, who just wants to keep Carl happy, says, sure thing, Carl. Put it in your checking account. Take your time. Whatever floats your boat.
And if Diane overhears that conversation, she is going to sprint out of her office and literally tackle Frank to the floor.
But why? I mean, if it's Carl's money and he intends to put it into an IRA eventually, why does Diane care where it sits for the summer?
Because of the draconian nature of that 60-day rule. If Carl deposits that check into a non-qualified account, like his personal checking, the IRS starts a 60-day countdown timer. He has exactly 60 days to move those funds into a new qualified retirement account.
And if he misses it?
If he waits 61 days, or if he just spends the money on a boat, the IRS no longer considers it a rollover in transit. They reclassify it as a full, permanent, early withdrawal.
Which means Carl's entire 50 grand is instantly added to his taxable income for the year.
Yes. Plus, if he is under the age of 59 and a half, he gets hit with an additional 10% early withdrawal penalty. So Frank's casual advice almost costs Carl tens of thousands of dollars in totally unavoidable tax liabilities.
That is brutal. But wait, if the IRS knows this is so dangerous, why do they even allow indirect rollovers? Like, why give Carl the check at all? Why not just mandate that the old 401k company wires the money directly to Frank's broker-dealer?
Well, that is called a direct institution-to-institution transfer, or a direct rollover, and it is absolutely what Diane wants Carl to do. Direct transfers don't trigger the 60-day clock, and they don't trigger the mandatory 20% IRS withholding tax that often applies when a check is made payable directly to the customer.
So why allow the check method?
The rules still allow indirect rollovers because some customers just need to bridge a financial gap, or they are consolidating accounts across different banking systems that don't interface cleanly. However, they are restricted to doing this kind of indirect customer-received rollover only once per rolling 12-month period.
The 60-day once-per-year trap. Good to know.
Huh.
Okay, before we move the money into the actual market, Diane has one strict rule about account opening that sounds simple but is tested relentlessly on the exam. Disclosures.
Right. When a firm provides risk disclosures, whether for options, margin, or day trading, the rule is absolute. Match every disclosure to its actual product, never to the account as a whole.
I always picture the account as just a plastic bucket. The bucket itself isn't dangerous, right? And you don't hand a customer a 10-page legal warning just for holding an empty bucket.
Exactly.
You hand them the warning when they decide to put radioactive material like uncovered options inside the bucket.
That's the perfect operational mindset. The paperwork follows the risk profile of the specific asset class, not the general account wrapper. Now, let's talk about the physical plumbing of the firm. How does the money actually get into Carl's bucket? This is cashiering.
Cashiering. It sounds so quaint, like a guy with a green visor standing behind a brass register. But in a modern broker-dealer, it's a high-stakes, highly regulated web of money movement.
It really is. Cashiering runs on two distinct tracks,
yeah.
External and internal. External systems bridge the firm to the outside banking world. These are your wire transfers routed through the Federal Reserve System, or ACH transfers, the automated clearinghouse, which process in batches and take a little longer.
Right. And internal systems.
That is a journal entry, moving money or assets between two accounts held within the same broker-dealer.
So if Frank wants to journal money from Carl's individual account to Carl's joint account with his wife, he just presses the button, right?
Not without the proper authorization. Every single movement of assets requires an ironclad paper trail. Frank cannot just journal money because he assumes Carl wants it done. He needs a signed letter of authorization, or LOA.
Okay, paper trail. Got it.
And if it's a significant transfer, especially to a third party, Diane will require a medallion signature guarantee.
What exactly is that?
It's a specialized banking stamp that physically guarantees the authenticity of the signature and shifts a financial liability to the stamping bank if it turns out to be forged. Or, alternatively, the movement is dictated by a customer's pre-existing standing sweep instructions, which automatically move idle cash into a money market fund.
Okay, but what happens when Carl finally realizes that Frank is a reckless maniac, and Carl decides he wants to take his entire bucket of assets and move it to a completely different, highly respectable brokerage firm?
That initiates one of the most critical operational workflows in the entire industry, ACATS, the Automated Customer Account Transfer Service.
ACATS, operated by the National Securities Clearing Corporation, the NSCC. How does this actually work? I mean, if Carl has cash, Apple stock, and some obscure municipal bonds, how does it all move without getting lost in the ether?
Well, ACATS is designed specifically for whole account transfers or designated asset transfers where large blocks are moved systematically. If Carl just wanted to move 10 shares of a single stock while leaving the rest of his account open, that partial transfer often happens outside of the automated ACATS environment.
Oh, interesting.
But for a full transfer, Carl goes to his new firm, the receiving member, and signs a transfer initiation form. The new firm pings Frank's firm, the carrying member, through the ACATS system.
And what is Frank's firm required to do the exact second they get that ping?
They must immediately freeze Carl's account.
Let's push on that logic for a second. Why freeze the whole account? If Carl has Apple stock in cash and he just wants to transfer it, why can't he keep day trading his Apple stock while the assets are in transit? Why does the system force him to just sit on his hands for days?
Consider the downstream systemic risk of a moving target. The ACATS process requires the two firms to validate exactly what assets Carl has, agree on the ledger, and then orchestrate a massive electronic handover at the clearinghouse level.
Right.
If Carl is simultaneously executing buy and sell orders for Apple stock while the firms are trying to lock in his exact share count, the ledgers will never reconcile. The receiving firm might think they are getting 100 shares, but Carl just sold 50 of them an hour ago.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah, the trade settlement will fail, margin deficits could spike, and the entire transfer will collapse. So freezing the account prevents chaotic overlapping trades and ensures a clean snapshot of the assets.
Okay, you can't take inventory of a train while it's speeding down the tracks. But what about the stragglers? Let's say Carl's account is frozen, the transfer finishes on Friday. But the following Tuesday, a dividend payment from Apple finally hits Frank's firm. Does Carl lose his dividend because his account is closed?
No, the ATAS architecture handles this beautifully through residual credit sweeps. The carrying member attaches a snapshot of what its books show at the time of the freeze, moves the bulk of the assets, and then systematically sweeps any residual credits like late arriving dividends or interest payments over to the new firm in the weeks following the transfer.
Okay, listener, perk up. This is a massive, highly testable exam trap regarding ACATS. We need to walk through this slowly.
Yes, definitely pay attention to this.
Let's say Careless Carl's actual financial advisor, the registered rep who works under Frank, decides to quit Frank's firm and take a job at a rival broker-dealer. Carl really likes this rep, so Carl submits an ACATS request to move his entire account to the rival firm to follow his advisor.
Happens all the time.
Right. But Frank is furious. Frank views Carl as firm property, and he is losing thousands of dollars in commissions. So Frank logs into the ACATS system and rejects the transfer request, claiming there is a legal dispute over whether the rep violated a non-compete clause by stealing the client. Can Frank hold Carl's money hostage over a staffing dispute?
Absolutely not. And the exam will try to lure you in with distractor answers, suggesting that a firm can delay an ACATS transfer if there is pending litigation with the broker or if the customer hasn't paid an account closure fee. Ignore all of that noise. A customer's transfer request stays fiercely protected when a rep changes firms. The customer owns the assets, not the firm.
So Frank cannot weaponize the back office to fight a front office employment battle.
Precisely. In fact, there are very few things that can actually defeat or delay an ACATS transfer request. The primary legitimate blocker is a lien or a bona fide claim on the assets.
What does that look like operationally?
Let's say Carl has a margin account, and he owes Frank's firm $10,000 in margin debit. Frank holds a lien on Carl Securities as collateral for that loan. If the new firm refuses to accept the margin debit along with the assets, Frank has a bona fide claim. He can legally reject the transfer until Carl pays off the debt, but he can never reject it simply out of spite.
Understood. Now, before we close out this front door segment, we have to talk about physical checks. In an era of instantaneous wires and ACATs, physical checks still exist, and they are an operational nightmare.
They really are, and the rules governing them are archaic but strictly enforced. If a firm receives a physical check from a customer, it must move through a highly controlled, traceable issuance process. It has to be immediately recorded in a blotter, which is a daily ledger of receipts and deliveries.
And Diane watches that blotter to ensure Frank isn't playing games with the float.
Exactly. The regulators prohibit any form of check kiting. It's fraudulently writing checks between multiple bank accounts to artificially inflate balances using the clearing time or the float. There can be no alteration of the payee information, and firms cannot place extended unreasonable holds on customer checks beyond what the banking regulations allow.
So we've successfully navigated the front door. We've separated CIP from KYC. We've navigated the 60-day rollover minefield, and we've proven that Frank can't hold Carl's assets hostage during an ACT's transfer.
Which brings us to the core function of the broker-dealer. Once the money and securities are sitting inside the firm, what is Frank legally allowed to do with them?
Right. This is where we shift to segment two, holding the bag. Custody, margin, and settlement. Because now that Frank, the founder, is sitting on millions of dollars of customer assets, the temptation to use those assets to enrich himself is overwhelming.
And this is exactly why the rules of custody and control are the absolute bedrock of customer protection in the securities industry. The SEC's customer protection rule, Rule 15C33, dictates exactly how a firm must hold assets. The entire philosophical point is to protect the customer's economic interest, ensuring that if Frank's firm goes bankrupt tomorrow, Carl's assets are walled off and returned to him, completely untouched by Frank's creditors.
Safekeeping and segregation. You keep the assets safe, and you keep them fundamentally separate from the firm's proprietary trading desk.
Yes. Operationally, the firm must promptly obtain and maintain physical possession or control of all fully paid customer securities, as well as any excess margin securities.
Let's define control real quick, because Frank isn't literally holding stock certificates in a safe in the back room anymore. All right.
No, the industry has totally dematerialized. Control status generally means the securities are held in a recognized secure location where they are unencumbered. This usually means they are sitting at a central clearing depository, like the DTCC, or at a recognized custodian bank, or held in a special omnibus account that is clearly designated for the exclusive benefit of customers.
Okay, listener, it is time for another direct question. I want you to picture careless Carl's portfolio. Carl has a margin account. He borrowed a little bit of money from Frank to buy a volatile tech stock.
Right.
But Carl also has a massive, diverse portfolio of blue chip stocks that he paid for entirely in cash. Those are his fully paid securities.
Wait, keep that in mind.
Now, Frank's firm is going through a liquidity crunch. A massive hedge fund approaches Frank and says, hey, we want to aggressively short those blue chip stocks. We need to borrow them, and we will pay you a massive lending fee. Can Frank look at Carl's account and say, well, Carl owes me a little bit of money on the margin side, so I'm just going to scoop up his fully paid blue chip stocks and lend them out to this hedge fund to make a quick buck. Take a guess.
The exam loves testing the boundaries of rehypothecation and securities lending here.
Can Frank lend out the fully paid shares just because a margin debt exists elsewhere in the account?
Absolutely not. It is a severe violation of the segregation rules. A firm must have explicit written authorization, a signed loan consent agreement, before they can borrow or lend any customer securities.
Makes sense.
But more importantly, a firm can never, under any circumstances, lend out fully paid securities or excess margin securities to finance the firm's business, regardless of what the customer owes on the margin side. The margin debt allows Frank to pledge a specific formulaic amount of securities up to 140% of the debit balance, but the rest must be strictly segregated and locked down.
Diane would be running the daily stock record break reports, and the second she sees Frank moving fully paid customer shares into a stock loan conduit, she would shut the entire desk down.
She has to. Firms are required to conduct independent counts and stock record verifications regularly to catch exactly these kinds of discrepancies between what the firm owes customers and what the firm actually has in its control locations.
Okay, let's look at a different type of custody friction. Restricted securities.
Mm.
Sometimes careless Carl gets access to a private placement, or he receives shares as compensation, and these shares come with a restrictive legend. It's literally a stamp or an electronic marker that says, this security cannot be sold in the public market.
These are control securities or restricted securities. The SEC provides safe harbor rules, most notably Rule 144, which dictate how and when these can eventually be sold. Typically, there is a mandatory holding period of 6 months or 1 year before the investor can legally dump them into the public market.
So Carl sits on his hands for a year. The 365th day arrives.
Yeah.
Does the restriction just magically evaporate like a timer running out in a video game?
Yeah.
Can you just hit the sell button on day 366?
That is the exact misconception the exam will test you on. The passage of time satisfies the regulatory holding period, meaning the resale safe harbor is now open. But time does not automatically remove the restrictive legend from the security itself.
Wait, so Carl is staring at his computer screen.
Mm-hmm.
He is legally allowed to sell, but the system still rejects the trade because the electronic legend is still sitting on the CUSIP.
Exactly. Operationally, the restrictive legend must be affirmatively removed by the issuer's transfer agent. To get the transfer agent to act, Diane has to facilitate a complex workflow. She usually needs a legal opinion letter from Securities Counsel confirming that the conditions of Rule 144 have been met. She submits the paperwork, often requiring a medallion signature guarantee, and only then will the transfer agent physically or electronically strip the legend off the shares. Until that happens, the shares are not considered good delivery for settlement.
I love this analogy. It's like turning 21. Just because it's midnight on your birthday doesn't mean the bartender automatically hands you a drink. You still have to show your ID to prove it and get the wristband. The condition was met, but the administrative hurdle remains.
That's a perfect transition, actually, because margin trading has its own set of bouncers and bartenders regulating who gets to trade.
Let's get deeply into margin. Borrowing money from the broker-dealer to buy more stock than you actually have the cash to afford. This is where careless Carl destroys his net worth.
And operationally, Diane has to ensure that Carl's destruction doesn't drag the firm down with him. First and foremost, margin borrowing never happens automatically. It requires explicit account approval by a principal and a signed margin agreement from the customer, which includes a hypothecation agreement pledging the securities as collateral.
Right, because collateral alone never authorizes credit. Just because Carl has $5 million sitting in his account doesn't mean Frank can just start executing trades that exceed Carl's cash balance. He needs the signature.
Exactly. Once the account is open, Diane has to monitor Carl's trading against two completely distinct margin regimes, Regulation T and Maintenance Margin.
These two concepts constantly confuse candidates. Let's do a direct, detailed comparison.
Regulation T is set by the Federal Reserve Board. It governs the initial extension of credit from the broker-dealer to the customer. For a standard long equity purchase, Reg T requires the customer to deposit 50% of the purchase price.
Going back to our nightclub analogy, Reg T is the massive bouncer standing outside the club. He doesn't care what happens later. He only cares about getting you in the door. If Carl was to buy $10,000 worth of stock, the Federal Reserve bouncer says, the cover charge is 50%. You must hand me $5,000 in cash right now or you cannot enter the trade. That is initial margin.
Correct. But once Carl is inside the club, the Federal Reserve bouncer steps away. Now, Carl's position is monitored by the bartender inside the club, which represents maintenance margin.
And maintenance margin is set by Famernaw and the exchanges, not the Fed, right?
Yes. Maintenance margin dictates the ongoing equity required to keep the position open as the market value fluctuates. For a standard long stock position, maintenance margin requires the customer to maintain equity equal to at least 25% of the current market value.
So Carl is sitting at his VIP table. The stock price starts dropping. His equity shrinks. The Fenerab bartender taps him on the shoulder and says, look, buddy, your equity just dropped below 25% of the total value. You need to deposit more cash right now to maintain your seat, or I'm liquidating your position and throwing you out.
That is a maintenance call. Reg T gets you in the trade. Maintenance keeps you in the trade.
What happens when Carl decides to short a stock? This is where the operational accounting gets really weird.
Short selling introduces theoretically infinite risk because there is no ceiling to how high a stock price can go. Therefore, the margin requirements are significantly more punitive. The total Regulation T requirement for shorting a stock is 150%.
Hold on, let's break that math down carefully. 150% sounds like a typo. If Carl wants to short $10,000 of stock, he has to put up $15,000 in cash.
No, let's walk through the back office accounting of a short sale. When Carl sells short $10,000 worth of stock, he is selling borrowed shares into the market. That sale generates $10,000 in cash, which sits in Carl's account as a credit balance. That represents 100% of the value.
Okay, filling.
Then Regulation T requires Carl to deposit his own cash equal to 50% of the value, which is $5,000. So the total credit balance sitting in the short margin account is $15,000. The 100% from the proceeds of the sale plus the 50% initial margin deposit. That is where the 150% figure comes from.
Okay, that clarifies it immensely. The 100% is just the cash he generated from the hostage shares he sold, and the 50% is the actual bouncer cover charge he brought from home. And what about the bartender? What is the maintenance requirement for shorting?
Short maintenance is completely separate from long maintenance, and it's price-tiered. Generally, for stocks trading above $5 a share, the maintenance requirement is 30% of the current market value, or $5 per share, whichever is greater. If the stock drops below $5, the rules get even stricter to prevent cheap penny stocks from exploding and wiping out the firm's capital.
Now, because margin is so inherently dangerous, we need to revisit disclosures.
Mm-hmm.
When does Diane mandate that Frank send Carl the margin risk disclosure document?
If Frank had his way, he would bury it in a 200-page terms and conditions PDF during onboarding and never mention it again. But the rule is highly specific. The margin risk disclosure must be provided before or at the time of opening a non-institutional margin account.
Yeah, makes sense. Warn him before he trades.
But it doesn't stop there. The firm must also provide that same disclosure to the margin customer at least once a year thereafter for as long as the account remains open.
Before opening, AND annually. So every single year, Carl gets a piece of paper reminding him that the firm can sell his stock without contacting him, and that he is not entitled to an extension of time on a margin call.
Exactly. And speaking of extensions, you need to know the operational timelines for these calls. If Carl gets a Regulation T call, meaning he didn't bring enough money to the bouncer at the door, how long does he have to pay it?
I know standard settlement recently moved to T plus one, so how does that affect Reg T?
A Regulation T call must be met within one payment period. Historically, the Fed defined this as standard settlement plus 2 business days. When settlement was T plus 2, the payment period was T plus 4. The core concept is that the customer has a very short, federally mandated window to deposit the initial funds before the firm is required to liquidate the position to cover the shortfall.
What about maintenance calls, when the bartender taps you on the shoulder?
Maintenance calls are different. They must be met promptly. The firm can liquidate you immediately if they choose. But for regulatory reporting purposes to FINRA, if a maintenance call remains completely unsatisfied beyond 15 business days, it becomes a severe reporting issue.
Let's add one more layer of complexity for Carl. Pattern day trading. Carl loves sitting in his pajamas, drinking energy drinks, and hitting the buy and sell buttons 40 times a day on the same stock.
Day trading introduces extreme intraday volatility risk. The back office systems must track the customer's intraday margin level, their day trading buying power. If Carl exceeds his buying power, he creates a day trading margin call.
And what if he just ignores it? What if he keeps day trading and leaves the deficit unsatisfied past the 5th business day?
Then the hammer drops. The firm's automated systems will flag the account, and Carl faces a strict 90-day restriction.
What does that restriction actually do operationally?
For 90 days, his margin privileges for day trading are essentially frozen. He is restricted to trading strictly on a cash available basis. He can only buy securities if he has the fully cleared, settled cash sitting in the account before the trade is executed. It completely kneecaps his ability to leverage his positions intraday.
90 days in time out. Ouch. Okay, we talked about how Carl gets into these trades. Let's talk about how the firm actually processes them, the plumbing of the market. What happens when Carl clicks buy and Frank's trading desk executes the order?
This is the settlement life cycle, and it is a marvel of operational engineering. The ideal flow, when everything works perfectly, follows a strict sequence. Step one is comparison.
The trade matching phase.
Yes. Before any money or securities move, the buyer and the seller must agree that they actually did a trade. They compare the security description, the price, the volume, and the settlement date. Once both sides agree, they have a locked-in trade.
Step two is DVP, delivery versus payment.
I want to emphasize how critical DVP is to the global financial system. Why not just have Frank send the stock certificates on Monday and trust the counterparty to wire the money on Tuesday?
Because that introduces catastrophic counterparty credit risk.
Mm.
If Frank delivers the stock on Monday and the other firm files for bankruptcy on Monday night, Frank just gave away his assets for free, and his firm takes a massive loss.
Exactly. DVP links the delivery of the securities to the movement of the money simultaneously. It is an electronic hostage exchange. The clearinghouse ensures that the briefcase of money slides across the table at the exact millisecond the briefcase of stock slides across. Neither side takes the other's credit risk.
That's brilliant. And step three is continuous net settlement, or CNS, operated by the clearinghouse. How does this actually reduce the workload for Diane?
Imagine Frank's firm executes 1,000 different trades in Microsoft stock today with 50 different broker-dealers. If he had to settle each trade individually, Diane would have to orchestrate 1,000 different DVP exchanges. It would be an operational nightmare. CNS eliminates that through Novation.
Novation?
Yeah.
The clearinghouse steps into the middle of every trade.
Yes. The National Securities Clearing Corporation, the NSCC, becomes the buyer to every seller and the seller to every buyer. Instead of Frank settling with 50 different firms, the CNS system totals up all of Frank's Microsoft purchases and subtracts all of his Microsoft sales. It reduces his entire day's activity in that security to a single net long or net short position. At the end of the day, Frank either owes the clearinghouse one net block of shares, or the clearinghouse owes Frank one net block of shares. The efficiency is staggering.
But wait, stop right there. Let's break the ideal flow, because Frank is clumsy. What happens when Frank completely messes up a trade? He hits the wrong button. He thinks he bought 10,000 shares from a counterparty, but that counterparty is sitting there saying, Frank, we have no record of this order. We didn't sell you anything.
This is a settlement stall. The back office calls it a break, and the Series 99 expects you to match the specific type of operational stall to its specific regulatory cure. We have three main mechanisms to compare directly: the DK notice, the buy-in, and the closeout.
Let's start with the DK notice. Don't know.
A DK notice is used during that very first step we discussed, comparison. If a firm receives a confirmation for a trade it does not recognize, or if the terms are wildly incorrect, it electronically issues a DK notice.
So DK is asking, did this trade even happen?
Yes. It settles the existence of the contract before settlement day even arrives. It forces the two parties to get on the phone, look at their order tickets, and figure out if someone made a typo or if Frank just hallucinated a trade.
Okay, so DK happens early. What is a buy-in? This sounds much more violent.
A buy-in happens later in the cycle when the trade was locked in and agreed upon, but the seller simply fails to deliver the securities on settlement date. The buyer is sitting there with a massive hole in their inventory and their customer is waiting for their shares.
Let's walk through the friction of this. Frank sold shares he couldn't actually source. He fails to deliver to the counterparty. Does the counterparty just wait forever?
No. The buying firm sends a formal written notice of intent to buy in. If Frank still doesn't deliver the shares, the buying firm goes out into the open market and executes a buy-in. They purchase the securities from a third party at the current market price to close out their uncompleted contract.
And what if the market price has skyrocketed since the original trade with Frank?
That is Frank's problem. The buying firm charges any price difference plus execution costs directly to Frank's firm. A buy-in transfers the market risk of the fail directly back to the failing seller.
Ouch. So DK is, who are you? And buy-in is, I am tired of waiting. I will buy it myself and bill you for the privilege. What is a closeout?
A closeout is conceptually similar, but it operates at the clearing agency level. It binds the clearing agency participant on a specific hard deadline set by the source of the fail. It forces the failing party to resolve the deficit by a mandatory cutoff, often resulting in the clearinghouse automatically closing the position out against them.
Okay, we have explored the plumbing. We know how money moves, how margins are calculated, and how trades settle or fail. This brings us organically to the next massive phase of the back office, the paper trail. Trade reporting, confirmations, and regulatory financials.
Right, because careless Carl is trading, the settlement systems are grinding away, and now diligent Diane has to make sure all the data matches, the regulators are informed, and the firm has enough cash to survive another day.
Let's start with trade reporting. When a transaction is executed on the trading desk, Frank has to report it to the tape so the public knows the price and volume. But he can't just report anything he wants.
No, a trade report requires a strict belief that the transaction is bona fide. It must be a real arm's-length execution. Furthermore, if Frank's firm is acting as a market maker and putting out a quotation, a firm bid, or a firm ask, he must honor that stated price offer. It is firm under its stated conditions. You cannot broadcast a price to the market and then back away when another dealer tries to hit your bid, except under one very narrow size exception.
Backing away is a massive violation. You also have to report your capacity on the trade, right?
Yes. Capacity dictates the firm's legal role in the transaction, and it drastically changes the firm's risk profile. The report must state whether the firm acted as an agent or a principal.
Let's clarify the operational difference for Diane.
If the firm acts as an agent, they are merely a middleman. Carl wants to buy stock, Frank goes into the market, finds a seller, connects them, and charges Carl a commission for the matchmaking service. The firm takes no market risk.
Oh, well.
But if the firm acts as a principal, they are a dealer. Carl wants to buy stock, and Frank sells it to him directly out of the firm's own inventory, charging a markup. The firm takes market risk on the inventory they hold.
But let's be real. Frank is entering these trade reports manually, and Frank is clumsy. He punches in the wrong execution date or the wrong time. How does Diane fix the permanent public record?
She has an arsenal of specific trade reporting fixes, and the exam expects you to know exactly which fix to apply to which scenario. Let's compare them side by side. First, the Assoff report.
In the Assoff report, this is a time machine.
Exactly. It is used to restore the original execution date to a late report. If Frank executed a trade for Carl on Tuesday afternoon, but the system glitched and Frank completely forgot to report it until Wednesday morning, Diane files it Assoff Tuesday. This ensures the audit trail reflects the economic reality of when the trade actually occurred, even though the report is late.
Okay, what about a past settlement date correction?
This addresses a totally different timeline. This is used when a massive operational error is caught extremely late in the cycle after the settlement day has already passed. The money and securities have already moved incorrectly, and Diane has to go back and unwind the structural damage.
And what if Frank realizes he reported the trade to the wrong facility, or the reporting system itself had a structural error?
Then Diane executes a trade reporting facility, or TRF, correction. This is a heavy-handed fix. It completely reverses the original faulty report and refiles a brand new correct one, leaving a clear footprint of the reversal in the tape.
Now, while Diane is scrambling to fix Frank's reporting errors, where does the actual messed up trade sit? Let's say Frank bought 10,000 shares of the wrong stock for Carl. Does that wrong stock just sit in Carl's account while Diane tries to figure it out?
Never. That would contaminate the customer's ledger. This is why every firm must maintain a designated error account.
Ah, the quarantine zone.
Exactly. The error account isolates the mistake. Diane pulls the radioactive, incorrect trade completely out of Carl's clean books and moves it into the firm's proprietary error account. The firm takes ownership of the mistake, absorbs any market loss required to liquidate the wrong position, and ensures the customer's account is made perfectly whole. The customer should never suffer the economic consequences of Frank's fat fingers.
So Diane fixes the trade in the error account. Now she has to communicate the real trade to Carl. This brings us to customer communications, statements, confirmations, and tax forms.
People use these three terms interchangeably in normal conversation, but on the Series 99, mixing them up will cost you points. They serve entirely different legal purposes.
Let's define the boundaries. What exactly is an account statement?
An account statement is the broad overview. It tells the customer what is currently held in the account and summarizes all activity that happened during a specific period, like a month or a quarter. It shows the net worth, the dividend sweeps, the total fees.
Okay, so that's the monthly recap. What is a trade confirmation?
A confirmation is granular and immediate. It tells the customer exactly what the firm did in what capacity on one specific transaction. And it must be sent by the time of completion of the transaction, usually settlement. It says, Carl, on this exact date, you bought 100 shares of XYZ at $50 a share, and we acted as your agent, charging a $5 commission.
And a tax form, like a 1099?
A tax form communicates strictly with the customer and the IRS. It focuses on the adjusted basis. It tracks the original cost basis of a security, factors in complex required adjustments like wash sale disallowances or corporate actions, and gives you the final definitive number required for tax reporting.
Okay, listener, it's trap time again. Are you ready? Careless Carl is tired of getting so much mail. He hates the daily PDFs hitting his inbox. He calls Frank and says, Frank, stop sending me a trade confirmation every single time I do a small trade. I don't care. Just roll all that data into my quarterly periodic statement. That is enough for me.
Seems reasonable enough to Carl.
Right. Can Frank agree to that? Can a firm send a periodic report instead of an immediate trade confirmation?
Think carefully about the operational friction here. Can a customer just verbally wave away immediate transparency?
The answer is yes, BUT.
Yes, but under incredibly strict conditions. You can substitute a periodic report for an immediate confirmation only with prior written consent from the customer. And even then, it is only allowed for certain types of systematic recurring plans, like a monthly mutual fund sweep program or a dividend reinvestment plan. You absolutely cannot do it for Carl's active, discretionary day trading.
Okay, here's an even better scenario. the false price rule. Frank is manually generating a confirmation for Carl's latest trade. Frank fat fingers the price. Carl actually bought this stock at $100 a share, but Frank types in $10 a share. This makes Carl look like a genius who got the deal of a lifetime. His apparent profit on the confirmation is massive. Frank realizes the error before he mails it, but he figures, hey, this error makes the client incredibly happy. I'll just leave it. I'm not cheating him out of anything. I'm just making him feel rich. Is this okay, since the error actually benefits the customer?
Absolutely prohibited. It is a severe violation of FINRA rules. A false price on a confirmation is a violation regardless of which way it tilts the numbers. The regulators do not care if the error makes the customer look richer or poorer. A false record destroys the integrity of the audit trail. If FINRA allows helpful false records, they can no longer trust any ledger in the industry.
You cannot lie on the paperwork, even to be nice. And what if Frank just decides, well, if the confirmation is wrong, I just won't send it at all. If I don't send it, it can't be false.
Withholding a required document is equally prohibited. Even if every piece of data on that unsent document was going to be 100% accurate, hiding the ball from the customer is a violation.
Which brings us to the ultimate overseer of this entire paper trail, regulatory financial requirements. This is Diligent Diane's true kingdom. She is the financial and operations principal.
Yes, the FinOps principal. She holds final personal regulatory responsibility for the firm's financial health. She supervises the staff preparing the reports, and crucially, she supervises the general ledger, the central accounting record that supports literally every calculation, every asset, and every liability in the firm.
And from that massive ledger, Diane derives the holy grail of back office reporting, the FOTHIS report.
The Financial and Operational Combined Uniform Single Report, filed electronically with the SEC and FANRNA. It is the comprehensive snapshot of the firm's financial and operational health.
Now, when Diane is crunching the numbers for the FOTHIS report, she's tracking two major calculations that sound somewhat similar but serve completely opposing masters: net capital and the customer reserve formula. This is one of the hardest concepts on the exam. Let's break down how they actually work operationally.
Let's start with net capital, governed by SEC Rule 15C31. Net capital measures the firm's own regulatory resources. It is essentially the firm's ultra-liquid net worth. The fundamental regulatory question is, does Frank's firm have enough liquid cash and easily sellable assets to survive a sudden market crash without going bankrupt?
And it's not just regular accounting net worth. Diane has to apply haircuts, right?
Yes. If Frank holds volatile tech stocks in the firm's proprietary trading account, Diane cannot count those at 100% value for net capital. She has to apply a percentage haircut, a severe discount, to account for market risk. And illiquid assets, like the physical desks in the office or an uncollectible loan to a broker, those get a 100% haircut. They are completely deducted.
Oh, okay.
The required amount of net capital is sized dynamically to the firm's specific activities. A massive clearing firm that holds customer funds needs millions in net capital. A tiny introducing firm that just routes trades to a clearing firm needs much less.
So net capital is all about saving the firm from its own bad decisions. What is the customer reserve formula under Rule 15C33?
The reserve formula is a completely separate calculation, and it is purely about protecting the customers from the firm's bad decisions. Diane runs this calculation weekly. She compares customer credits, which is cash the firm owes to customers, like Carl's free credit balances against customer debits, which is cash customers owe the firm, like margin loans.
And what happens if the credits exceed the debits? If the firm owes the customers more cash than the customers owe the firm?
Then the firm is sitting on excess customer cash, and the rule demands action. Diane must calculate that exact excess amount, take the firm's own liquid funds, and literally deposit them into a heavily restricted separate bank account titled Special Reserve Bank Account for the Exclusive Benefit of Customers.
So net capital ensures Frank stays in business. The reserve formula ensures that if Frank's net capital drops to zero and the firm explodes, that special bank account is sitting there, fully funded, to guarantee careless Carl gets his cash back.
Precisely. There are two distinct walls of defense.
Now, what if Frank's firm is just too small to handle this massive back office burden? What if Diane says, Frank, I can't do this alone, and they sign a carrying agreement with a massive Wall Street clearing firm to process their trades and send their statements?
That is very common. An introducing broker relies on a carrying broker.
Does Frank get to just wash his hands of all compliance? Can he just say, not my problem anymore, the big guys in New York are handling it?
Never. Carrying agreements allocate specific customer account duties between the two firms. The clearing firm might agree to handle trade execution and mail the confirmations. Frank's firm retains the duty to supervise Carl's suitability and approve the new accounts. But the core rule is this. These agreements never erase either firm's assigned responsibility. You can outsource the operational work. You can never outsource the regulatory liability.
Okay, before we leave the paper trail, we need to talk about the literal hoarding of paper, the retention clocks. Let's dig into the why behind these clocks because it makes memorizing them much easier.
The regulators divide records into two main buckets, 3-year records and 6-year records.
What falls into the 3-year bucket?
3 years is for the transient day-to-day operational flow of the firm, order tickets, trade confirmations, retail communications, trial balances. These are the records that prove what happened on a specific day.
And what requires a 6-year retention?
6 years is for the structural bedrock of the broker-dealer, the heavy foundational records, blotters, general ledgers, customer account records, and the stock record that tracks all securities positions.
Why the mismatch? Why keep a ledger for 6 years, but a trade confirmed for 3?
Because if a systemic fraud is discovered 5 years down the line, FINRA doesn't necessarily need every single daily order ticket to reconstruct the crime. They can rebuild the financial reality of the firm using the general ledger and the blotters. The 6-year records are the architectural blueprints of the firm's history. The 3-year records are just the daily receipts.
And if Diane stores all of this electronically to save space, does she just dump it on a hard drive?
No, the SEC's electronic storage requirements are incredibly strict. The system must preserve the history through an immutable audit trail or non-rewritable storage, often referred to as WORM format. Write once, read many.
Ah, WORM.
Yes, it must automatically verify the quality of the recording process, and it must stay instantly accessible. If Frank tries to alter a ledger entry from 3 years ago, the WORM system will lock him out or create an undeletable red flag showing exactly what he tried to change.
Okay, we have opened the account. We've settled the trades, we've calculated the net capital, and we've locked the files in WORM storage. But all of this flawless operational machinery still relies on flawed human beings.
Which brings us to the final segment of our deep dive, behaving badly. Conduct, privacy, and control. This section governs how the firm interacts with the public, how it protects their data, and how it supervises its own rogue employees.
Let's start with how Frank talks to the public. Communications. The regulators sort written and electronic material by the size of the audience, right?
Yes. It is fundamentally a sizing exercise to determine the level of regulatory risk.
First category, correspondence.
Correspondence is defined as any written or electronic communication distributed to 25 or fewer retail investors within any 30 calendar day period.
Why 25? What is magical about that number?
It is the regulatory tipping point between personalized communication and a mass marketing campaign. If Frank emails 20 of his existing clients to explain a new market trend, that is considered targeted correspondence. The operational burden is relatively low. It requires post-use review and supervision, but usually not principal pre-approval.
But what if Frank buys an email list and blasts a stock tip to 500 people?
The second he crosses that 25-person threshold, it becomes a retail communication. The audience is larger, so the systemic risk of misleading the public is drastically higher. Retail communications generally require a registered principal to formally pre-approve the material before it is ever sent out.
And what if Frank is pitching a highly complex derivative strategy strictly to multi-billion dollar hedge funds and massive commercial banks?
That falls under institutional communication. It is strictly for institutional investors. The regulators operate on the assumption that massive banks have their own armies of lawyers and analysts to fend for themselves. So the rules are slightly looser. Pre-approval is often not required, though the material still cannot be fraudulent or misleading.
Okay, let's pivot to privacy. Because Careless Carl loves downloading sketchy apps and giving away his data, but Frank is legally bound to protect Carl's financial secrets.
This is governed by Regulation SP, which protects a consumer's non-public, personally identifiable financial information.
Reg SP, for secret privacy, is how I remember it. What does it actually force Diane to do?
It requires the firm to provide a clear privacy notice at the time the account is opened and annually thereafter. But the operational friction point is the opt-out choice.
How does the opt-out work?
If Frank wants to take a list of his wealthiest clients and share that non-public personal information with a non-affiliated third party like a luxury car dealership that wants to target them with ads, Frank cannot just hand over the list. He must give Carl a reasonable opportunity to opt out of that disclosure before the data is shared.
And Frank has to actively defend the back office servers from hackers.
Yes. Reg SP mandates written safeguard policies. Diane has to implement cybersecurity protocols, threat protection, and unauthorized access alarms.
Okay, listener, wake up. Put your phone down. Yeah. We have another massive exam trap incoming regarding privacy and street name ownership. This is a scenario I guarantee you will see in some form. Let's walk through it.
This is a big one.
Careless Carl buys 1,000 shares of a publicly traded robotics company. The shares are held in street name at Frank's firm, meaning the clearinghouse sees Frank's firm as the record owner, but Carl is the beneficial owner. The robotics company is holding its annual shareholder meeting, and the CEO of that company wants to know exactly who is buying their stock so they can send them a nice welcome letter. But Carl has to make an election on his account form, OBO or NOBO.
Objecting beneficial owner or non-objecting beneficial owner.
Right. If Carl chooses OBO, objecting, he says to Frank, no, do not tell the robotics company who I am. Keep my name a secret. If he chooses NOBO, not objecting, he says, sure, pass my name and address along to the issuer. Here's the trick question the exam will throw at you. Does choosing OBOs or NOBO change who actually legally owns the stock? Does it affect Carl's right to vote his proxy shares?
The exam desperately wants you to think that OBO means the broker-dealer retains ownership rights and NOBO means the customer gets the ownership rights.
But that is a complete lie.
It is entirely wrong. Neither election changes the beneficial ownership of the security. Carl owns the economic value of the shares regardless of what box he checks. The only thing that changes is the communication pathway.
If Carl is OBO and his name is a secret, how does he vote his shares?
Frank's firm acts as the blind intermediary. The robotics company sends the proxy voting materials in bulk to Frank's firm. Diane's team then forwards those materials to Carl. Carl votes, sends the vote back to Frank's firm, and Frank's firm submits the aggregate vote to the company without ever revealing Carl's identity. It is purely a privacy preference, not a property rights issue.
OBO and NOBO do not change ownership. Drill that into your brain. Okay, let's move on to the ultimate showdown in Diane's office. How does she handle trouble? We need to directly compare complaints versus red flags.
This is a critical operational distinction because escalating one never converts it into the other. They live on two completely separate regulatory tracks.
Let's start with a customer complaint. How does FINRA define it?
A customer complaint is a grievance from a customer or their authorized representative that is specifically tied to the member firm's covered activities. And listen to this operational nuance. The medium does not change the classification. Putting it in writing makes it a formal complaint.
Wait, what qualifies as writing today?
A formal letter on legal stationery is a complaint, but an angry email is also a complaint. A text message to Frank's business phone saying, "You executed my trade at the wrong price, you thief," is a formal regulatory complaint.
And how does Diane have to react to it?
Because it is a complaint, it is a defined regulatory event. The response is strict and mandated by FINRA Rule 4530. Diane must log it, investigate it, and report listed events promptly to FINRA through their electronic reporting portal.
Okay, so a complaint is a grievance you must report. What is a red flag?
A potential red flag falls under Regulation SID, which is the Identity Theft Red Flags Program. A red flag is a pattern, practice, or specific activity that suggests the possibility of identity theft. It is a risk indicator recognized before a crime is confirmed.
Give me a back office example.
Diane is reviewing a new account application. She runs the data through the CIP verification system. The social security number matches a legitimate person, but the address provided is a known mail drop associated with international fraud rings. Or Carl suddenly logs in from an IP address in a country he has never visited and immediately attempts to wire his entire account balance to an unknown third party.
That is a massive warning light on the dashboard. But how is the response different from a complaint?
You do not automatically report every red flag to FACTM. The regulatory response to a red flag is scaled to the actual assessed risk. Diane must investigate. She pauses the wire. She calls Carl on his verified phone number. Sometimes after investigating, she realizes Carl is just on vacation and forgot to tell anyone. The threat was a false alarm. So sometimes the proper response to a red flag means no regulatory reporting reaction at all.
So a complaint is a past tense grievance that triggers mandatory reporting. A red flag is a present tense threat that triggers an internal investigation. They are completely different workflows.
Right. Which leads us to the final piece of the broker-dealer puzzle, supervision and control. How does FINRA ensure that Frank is actually enforcing all of these incredibly complex rules instead of just ignoring them?
They require WSPs, written supervisory procedures. This is essentially the firm's massive internal instruction manual for not going to federal prison.
Yes, the WSPs document the firm's entire supervisory architecture. Who reviews the trades? How are the emails monitored? What is the escalation path for a stock record break? These procedures must be promptly amended whenever the SEC or FINRA changes a rule. But the real teeth of the supervisory system is FINRA Rule 3130.
The annual certification.
Yes. Once a year, the chief executive officer of the firm must formally certify that the firm has processes in place to establish, maintain, and review policies to achieve compliance with applicable securities laws.
Wait, Frank. Frank actually has to take a pen, sign his name to a legal document, and hand it to the regulators, swearing that his firm is compliant.
And that signature carries immense personal legal liability. If Frank signs that certification, but the SEC later discovers that the firm is actually running a lawless, chaotic back office with zero oversight, Frank cannot claim ignorance. He signed the document. He is in severe personal trouble.
Now, Frank, being Frank, he wants to maximize his profits and minimize his payroll. So he has a brilliant idea. He tells Diane, "Hey, I'm going to fire the compliance officer. I will be the primary proprietary trader for the firm. And to save money, I will also act as the designated principal who reviews and approves my own trades. And while I'm at it, I'll approve my own end-of-year bonus based on the profits I generate." Can he do that?
The foundational operational principle of segregation of duties absolutely forbids it. You cannot supervise your own work. You cannot report to a subordinate for compliance matters. And you cannot allow a subordinate to control your compensation.
You cannot grade your own homework.
Exactly. The WSPs must designate independent principals to test whether the supervisory structure is reasonably designed to prevent exactly that kind of blatant conflict of interest. The person trading the firm's capital cannot be the same person verifying the trade reports.
Finally, what happens when the literal infrastructure of the firm collapses? The building burns down, a hurricane floods the data center, or a massive cyber attack takes the internet offline for a week?
That triggers the business continuity plan, or the BCP.
Every firm has to have one, right?
Yes. The firm must have a written BCP detailing exactly how they will keep their core operational obligations moving through a significant business disruption. How will customers access their funds? Where is the backup data stored? This plan must be approved and annually reviewed by a registered principal who is also a member of senior management.
And how is this communicated to Careless Carl? Because Carl assumes Frank just runs the servers out of his garage. Does Frank have to mail a copy of the 50-page BCP to Carl every time Carl does a trade?
No, the regulators recognize that would be an absurd waste of paper. The BCP disclosure rules are pragmatic. A summary of the BCP must be provided to the customer in writing at account opening. It must be prominently posted on the firm's website, and it must be mailed to the customer upon request. It does not go on every trade confirmation or every monthly statement.
So if Carl wants to know how Frank plans to survive a zombie apocalypse, he just clicks the link at the bottom of Frank's homepage.
Assuming Frank actually paid the web hosting bill that month, yes.
Wow. Oh. Okay. We have covered the entire life cycle of the broker-dealer operations. Front door, holding the bag, the massive paper trail, and the human element. Let's bring this all home. Listener, take a breath. Roll your shoulders. You've absorbed a massive amount of technical machinery today. We're going to do a rapid-fire recap of the absolute most testable, high-yield takeaways from everything we just discussed. I want you to visualize these scenarios as we list them.
Let's lock it in.
Number one, the mismatch at the front door. General customer account records are kept for 6 years to align with FINRA arbitration. Identity records the anti-terrorism CIP documents are kept for 5 years.
Number two, the AC shield. An AC transfer protects the customer's absolute right to move their assets when a representative changes firms. The carrying firm cannot block the transfer out of spite or over an employment dispute. The only thing that legally halts the transfer is a lien or a bona fide claim, like an unpaid margin debit.
Number three, margin risk disclosures. They are not a one-and-done formality. They must be provided before or at the time of opening the account, and at least annually thereafter for the life of the account.
Number four, trade corrections in the audit trail. If you need to fix a late report, an ASOF report is used specifically to restore the original execution date, ensuring the economic reality of the trade is preserved on the tape.
And number five, the grand finale of operational fraps. Escalating a customer complaint never magically turns it into an identity theft red flag.
Yeah.
They follow totally separate regulatory paths. And electing OBO or NOBO never ever changes the actual legal or economic ownership of a security in street name.
That is a phenomenal summary of the core mechanics.
Now, as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with one final overarching thought to mull over as you continue your Series 99 studies. We've talked about a lot of highly specific granular rules today: haircuts, retention clocks, margin percentages, reporting formats. When you are staring at a textbook, it can feel like a random list of bureaucratic chores designed just to torture you.
But it is not random at all. There is a singular, unifying philosophy driving every single word of the Series 99 exam and the SEC regulations.
Exactly. Think about how every single mechanism we discussed, from segregating fully paid securities to freezing ACATS transfers to the customer reserve formula, is ultimately designed to do one specific thing: separate the firm's money from the customer's money. It is entirely about preventing the casino from reaching its hands into the vault when the casino starts losing. If you ever get stuck on a Series 99 question, if you're staring at four convoluted multiple choice answers and your mind goes totally blank, step back and ask yourself this one simple question: which of these answers best prevents Frank the founder from using careless Carl's assets to pay his own bills?
That is almost always the right answer. The rules exist solely to build that wall, to maintain that absolute segregation, and to ensure that when the dust settles and the firm fails, the customer's economic interest is flawlessly protected.
The wall of protection. I love it. Well, that is it for us today. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the operations professional material. Keep studying, keep visualizing the friction in the back office, and remember, don't be a careless Carl, and definitely don't let Frank grade his own homework. We will catch you on the next deep dive. Keep up the great work.